Public Radio, Vermont Edition, and I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. The Vermont State Police has 327 sworn members and 58 emergency dispatchers and civilian staff. The force provides primary law enforcement services to approximately 200 towns in Vermont. These are often the folks we count on when we dial 911. But the troopers in the green and gold face a growing problem from drug dealers. Traffic fatalities are up this year. Positions within the force remain unfilled. And troubling new data shows troopers were much more likely to stop and search black drivers compared to white drivers, something the force says it's working on. Joining us to talk about these issues and more is the director of the Vermont State Police, Colonel Matthew Birmingham. Colonel, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a more basic question. Could you explain how the jurisdiction of the state police differs from local police and county sheriff's departments?
Well, certainly. The state police has statewide law enforcement jurisdiction. And we are responsible, as you said, for covering about 200 towns across the state as the primary law enforcement agency. But we are also called upon by county and local agencies to provide assistance when needed. We also have special teams that respond to these areas for more complicated crimes and events that take place. And we assist all the county sheriffs and the local chiefs with their mission in keeping Vermonters safe.
So when I call 911, how does the dispatcher determine whom to send?
So the 911 system is run by the E911 board, and we have two 911 answering centers in our dispatcher PSAPs in Williston and Westminster. When the call comes in, it is put through a system that will push it to a dispatcher in that local area first. And if that center is overwhelmed with calls, the call will be bounced to a dispatcher in one of the other four centers that has been idle the longest. When they answer the call, they have a majority of the information from where the caller's coming from. It's a little more challenging with cell phones. And they will then ascertain the nature of the call and push it to whatever public agency, fire department, EMS, or law enforcement that it needs to go to, and they will dispatch resources to it.
All right. Colonel, you joined the state police in 1998, and much of your time, I understand, has been devoted to the drug task force. So I imagine you've had a front row seat when it comes to watching the state's heroin epidemic pretty much explode. How has that drug problem impacted the job of a state trooper?
Well, it's our number one challenge right now by far is the opiate epidemic. And I have been involved in the drug task force since 2002. And I've watched, unfortunately, the OxyContin epidemic take place from then on up to about 2009 and until its reformulation. And then after that, the explosion of heroin in Vermont. It has taken its toll on us. It has maxed out our resources as of late. And we are working very hard with our partners on the, the treatment and prevention side to stem the tide of heroin in Vermont. We can't do it alone. We are going to work very hard to stop the supply of heroin coming into Vermont. It's a challenge and one that we're constantly reevaluating and putting as many resources as we can toward it. Our strategy in Vermont, though, is a good strategy. There is no right answer to this. It's an extremely complicated problem, but going after this problem with a multifaceted approach is the right solution. We have to look at demand reduction. We cannot stop heroin alone from trying to stem the supply chains because it's a market. It's a black market, and it functions like any other market in the economy. And when there is a demand for the drug, the supply will get to the state. So we're working hard on the demand reduction and the supply chains. The other thing that's important that we can't forget is the prevention piece. Prevention should be our number one focus. So we should really try and stop this problem before it starts, because once you've gotten to the law enforcement end of things or the treatment end of things, you've really reached the end of the line. And we'd really like to try and prevent people from getting hooked on these drugs, because it's an awful addiction. It affects many Vermonters, and it's something we're really trying to work hard on.
Listeners, if you have a question or a comment about the state police, you can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or if you're on your computer, head over to vpr.net/Vermont Edition and you can post your thoughts there. We're talking with Colonel Matthew Birmingham. He heads up the state police. And Colonel, I want to ask you more specifically, when you started as a state trooper, I'm wondering what sorts of crimes, what sorts of things you encountered then versus what a trooper encounters today and how that relates to the heroin epidemic?
Well, we're seeing a tremendous increase in opiate-related crime. There's a lot of secondary crimes that take place, like burglaries and fraud, and any crime where people are attempting to acquire money to pay for their addiction. So those secondary crimes are certainly an issue that impact all of law enforcement in Vermont, and they grow with the epidemic because the more people are using, they have to find the resources to pay for their addiction. And sometimes addictions can become extremely expensive if you have a habit of 5 to 10 bags of heroin a day, and each bag is $15 to $20, you can do the math. It becomes very challenging for people who, unfortunately, are generally unemployed because of their addiction, and they will reach out and acquire the money in other ways, mostly illegal. So that becomes a challenge for us, and one that pushes our resources, not just within drug enforcement, but beyond that.
Vermont was one of a handful of states that recently won federal funds from the Justice Department to fight drug trafficking. I think the state police here in Vermont received $1.4 million. Talk about what that money is being used for and what kind of impact you think it may have.
Well, it's an incredibly important award for us, and I can't thank Senator Leahy and his staff enough for assisting us with that grant money. It will be very important. What we're using it for is we're going to staff our drug task force, which the state police manages and oversees, with 5 more criminal investigators, and we have an additional position for a criminal analyst. So what that does is it really puts more resources on the front lines of the investigations into these criminal networks. Now, it's the primary responsibility of the drug task force, working with our local and federal partners at DEA and ATF and FBI, to really identify the highest level supply chain operators that are bringing the heroin into Vermont, and it's our job to dismantle those networks. So we will continue to work on those efforts. The additional $1.4 million will provide us with the important resources on that front line, on the law enforcement perspective. But there's a lot of good things happening in treatment and prevention, too, and I just don't want to forget about that, because all 3 components really have to be in play in order for this to be successful.
Larry and Brandon emailed, over the past 3 or 4 years, he's noticed an increased awareness of the opiate problem in Vermont. And he's wondering, are things getting better than they were then, say 3 or 4 years ago? Are they about the same or worse? And how do you measure progress? I mean, you just talked about the fact that you've got more resources to use and prevention is being bolstered. But when you look at the crime on the streets, how do you measure?
Yeah, it's a very difficult problem to measure, and we've struggled with that over the years. I can tell you that heroin investigations in the drug task force are up 70% over the past year, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the problem is bigger. We look at a lot of different things. We look at the quantity of heroin that we're seizing on the street. We always are speaking with our partners in health and prevention about the wait times for treatment. When those numbers go up, you generally can see an increase in the demand. We've really gotten away from arrest. That's not very indicative of the problem. But what concerns me the most is the quantity of heroin that's coming into the state right now. We're seeing a tremendous growth in the amount that these networks are bringing in. And that's troubling because the more quantity obviously equates to more users. And so that's it's a difficult thing to measure. I would say that we are making progress, but we still have a long way to go.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Colonel Matthew Birmingham. He's director of the Vermont State Police. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for the colonel or other comments to share about the state police, you can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Moncton and talk with Cal. Hi, Cal. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
Hi, so I had a question in reference to just the resources that are being used in terms of prevention and then also just eradicating the supply chain that's coming in and kind of what those percentages are. And so, yeah, I guess that was my question.
Cal, you want to understand better how much money is being focused on prevention versus the law enforcement side?
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask that, throw that to the colonel. Do you have any breakdowns on that?
Well, I don't, unfortunately. I can't speak to prevention because it's just not my wheelhouse. I know it is, from my perspective, as one of the three pillars of this, it is probably the most critical component of the equation, because we really have to prevent young people. And I'm glad to hear that there's greater awareness about heroin and the dangers of heroin. And I'll add, too, that fentanyl is another incredibly dangerous drug that's entering Vermont. It's hit parts of New England very hard. It's extremely dangerous. And people are dying from it. So we really need to make sure that that awareness is out there and that education piece. Now, in terms of his question about the supply, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to calculate the amount of heroin coming into the state, because it's a black market and we just don't have that capability. We can get estimates based on the amount of heroin we're seizing, but it's a challenge to try and identify what percentage of the actual amount of heroin coming in that we're seizing.
All right. Well, let's take another call. Let's go to Hinesburg now and talk to Peter. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Peter, I'm getting about every other word. Let's see. Try asking your question one more time. We may have to go to a different caller, but I'll cross my fingers.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
My name's Peter, and I've been a recovering addict for 3 years now. I was addicted to heroin and crack cocaine. And my question is, it's another question about prevention. And I really like to get into community organizing somehow. And I'd like to know what your suggestion is for me. I've been thinking about going to high schools maybe and asking if I can go to classes or something.
So you're wondering, Peter, what you can do to help yourself or others in the community?
To help others in the community.
All right. Colonel Birmingham, do you have any thoughts, when you have a call like this where someone wants to reach out who's been through a lot, it sounds like. From your point of view, how do you think Peter might be helpful?
Well, first, Peter, congratulations on 3 years of sobriety. And I think that it's great that people that have those experiences want to step up and share them. I'm not the expert on where that would best be used, but certainly getting to the youth in Vermont and explaining your story to them, and I think it's incredibly brave that you're willing to do that, is important, because they need to understand the dangers of these drugs, and they need to understand what happens when people get addicted. And I don't think there's any better opportunity for them to listen and ask questions than from somebody like Peter to come in and explain his story to them. So it's important, because a lot of what we have seen in the past and what we're seeing is young people get addicted to heroin by starting with pills and prescription pills, and because there's this belief that prescription medication is safe, it is prescribed, it is manufactured by pharmaceutical companies, prescribed by doctors, and so that belief kind of makes it a little less daunting to people who might try it for the first time, instead of a heroin, and it has a little bit more of a stigmatism because of the needles and the way that it's distributed and manufactured and everything. So that kind of education, I think, is extremely important for them to understand that these powerful pain medications that are on the market can be very dangerous if not used properly and can lead to a very powerful addiction.
Let me take one more call on drugs and then we'll move on to a different topic. But let me go to David, who's calling from Shelburne. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yes. I have more of a comment. I run a shop here in Vermont Automotive, and, you know, we hire a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of my employees or coworkers and family, friends at this point going through this. And it seems to me that the resources are not there for these people unless they go and commit a crime. Even with insurance, the waiting list to go in and to rehabilitation, it doesn't seem like it's there at all. Unless you go and you commit a crime, then, you know, you then have some kind of resource where you're going to jail and maybe getting clean there.
David, I've got it. Let me pick that up with Colonel Birmingham, because I think your point's an interesting one, and that is that, you know, if you've got somebody with a drug problem that wants help, often they can't get that help. There aren't enough slots available until they take a more dramatic step. Is that, do you think that's accurate, Colonel Birmingham?
Well, I think it depends on where you are in the state. I know some areas of the state have longer waiting lines than others. I think that, and this is one of the reasons that the law enforcement component of this is important, is that you know, many times people seek treatment at the point of arrest. It takes a traumatic event, and this is what I've been told by people who have drug addictions, that it takes a traumatic event like an arrest or an overdose sometimes for them to actually reach the point where they can seek treatment. I'm not, you know, an expert on all of the resources that are available. I know that there are a lot of discussions going on around the state, both in the state house and in the criminal justice system, about making changes and reforms to the system where the arrest does not necessarily equate to just jail time. It equates to a system of treatment and ensuring that we don't have a revolving door where people who are committing crimes to satisfy their addiction or keep coming back into the criminal justice system. It's going to take time. It's a process. It obviously requires money and reform. But I think those discussions are taking place, and you know, we're moving in that direction.
I'm going to change topics and ask you about your brand new headquarters that just opened, $6.7 million facility in Westminster. Mm-hmm. Now, its construction meant the closure of the barracks in Brattleboro and Rockingham. But how will this new state-of-the-art facility make things better for troopers?
Yeah, and I just want to correct you real quick. It's not our headquarters. It's our Westminster Field Station.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. I just didn't want people to think that our headquarters was moving. Well, I'll tell you right now, it's a state-of-the-art facility. The people of Vermont should be proud of it. It is our fifth new facility in the state police. And it is taken two older barracks that were really behind the times on many different fronts and put it into one. So we've managed to improve efficiencies, both because now we're not running two facilities, we're running one. It provides a safe space for both our troopers and the public, because the public comes into the barracks for many different reasons, from meetings to filing complaints to having to get their fingerprints taken. There's a lot of reasons why they come there. There's a public meeting room that we let the public use. So it is it's really become a great location and a great space for us. And I can assure you that, because I know a lot of the comments I get are, well, how are we going to get the same services now that there's one barracks covering the same area? And I can assure you that I've addressed that with the commanders that run the Westminster Barracks and ensured that they have devised a system of patrol areas that keep the troopers. I mean, what we've come so far in our patrol capabilities now with our cruisers, we have our mobile data computers in our cars now. So troopers have access to just about everything they need on those computers in the field. So short of processing individuals or having to do certain paperwork, a lot of what a trooper can do now can be done out in the field. And that's really beneficial for us and for the people that we serve.
Listeners, we're talking about the role of the state police in Vermont, how that role has been impacted by the heroin epidemic, and what department officials are doing to address two disturbing reports that came out recently that showed non-white drivers are more likely to be stopped by state troopers, given citations, and searched than white drivers in Vermont. My guest is Colonel Matthew Birmingham. He's director of the Vermont State Police. Listeners, if you have a question for the colonel or a comment to make, maybe you've had to call the state police recently needing help on the highway, or maybe you've been pulled over. And if so, did you feel you were treated fairly and professionally by the trooper at the scene? We'd like to hear about it at 1-800-639-2211. And we will get to more questions after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and we're talking today about the Vermont State Police. My guest is Colonel Matthew Birmingham, Director of the Police. And listeners, you can take part in this conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can go to our Facebook page or to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Colonel, let's talk about reports that have recently come out showing racial disparities in traffic stops and incarceration rates in Vermont. A report issued this summer by the Sentencing Project, I believe that's a Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group, shows Vermont is one of five states where black people are incarcerated at more than 10 times the rate of white people, which is double the national average. There was also a report that came out in May that was an analysis of 5.5 years of Vermont State Police data that found minority drivers are stopped, cited, and searched by the Vermont State Police at a higher rate than white drivers, and that white drivers were more likely than minorities to get a warning rather than a citation. And both reports showed that searches of white and Asian drivers yielded contraband more frequently than searches of black or Hispanic drivers, despite the latter two groups being more likely to be stopped, searched, ticketed, and arrested. So, Colonel, what was your reaction when you learned of those reports?
Well, I just want to say that the Vermont State Police has really been a leader on this issue for the past decade, and we have taken some pretty bold steps, and even recently in addressing this issue. We are not we're not shying away from it. We're tackling it head on. This past year we appointed a senior level manager, a captain in our organization, Captain Ingrid Jonas, to be the first director of fair and impartial policing and community affairs for the state police, because I wanted to make sure that the organization, the public, knew that this was not just a phase or something that we just had to push people through training and it was going to go away. This is truly part of the culture of the state police and has been for over a decade. Captain Jonas chairs our Fair and Impartial Policing Committee, which is made up of representative members of the community, and we really rely on them for input on what we're doing right and what we can do better on this front. This is an extremely complicated issue. We can always improve on this. It is really about ensuring that our troopers understand what implicit biases are, and learning to, because all human beings have implicit bias, and once they identify what those implicit biases are, we have to ensure that they're trained to understand that they have to separate their implicit bias from their professional conduct. And we work with the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity to craft the training for our troopers. We've been collecting race data for 7 years before it was mandated by law. And last year, we pushed all that race data out to the public. It's on our website now, so anybody can have access to it. I want to work with Captain Jonas, as with the rest of the command staff, to really take the data, and we're in the process right now of doing data quality management, because the reports did identify some issues where we lacked data quality, but there were over 200.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there were traffic stops that had no race collected on them. So I think there were about 4,000 plus, and that can be significant if those 4,000 stops included minorities. It can sway, because the numbers are so small, it can sway the percentages higher. So we have to find out why those tickets did not have a selection, because the way it works is when you write a ticket to an operator, you have a choice on the back of the ticket. and it's the perception of the officer as to the race they check. But the training component, which we have to be better at and push through to the troopers, is that you must make a selection. You can't leave it blank if you're unsure of the race of the operator. Because I think what was happening is troopers were unsure and didn't feel comfortable making a decision. But when you leave it blank, it creates a larger problem for data review. So that's a training issue and something we're working on with the troopers. We're even looking at the data questions to see if there's anything we can change on that. But I really want to get to a point where we're evaluating this data much more frequently, and we can almost create an early warning system. Now, it's going to take time to get there because it's a tremendous amount of data. And if we can create an early warning system where we are seeing issues as they're happening, then we can address them quickly. And we address them in a variety of different ways, through training, through evaluations, and ultimately, if necessary, through discipline. But we really want to ensure that the training component is pushed down. The other issue, too, is that with the amount of data out there, I mean, data tells one story, and you really have to drill into why something's happening to figure out exactly what's taking place. And that's what we're doing. We're taking the reports right now. We're taking the data. We're taking the anomalies, and we're taking the concerns, and we're drilling into that data to determine if there were errors on the trooper's part, if there are real concerns, if there are training issues, and we're trying to address that.
Let me bring a caller into the discussion now. Mark is calling from Montpelier. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, Matthew. It's Mark from Justice for All. How are you?
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Pretty well. I just wanted to just take a hat off to you and just to let everybody know how much I appreciate the work that you guys have been doing on the state side. And, yeah, I would say by far the state police are leaps and bounds ahead of most of the rest of the organizations. And this is a really, really big discussion, so I just want to distill what I want to get at down to just something very simple. I think you just summarized it, Matthew, yourself. You said everyone has implicit bias. I think implicit bias is a great discussion surrounding this. And I guess my question is you know, what would you say to those who are over in the prosecutor's offices and those who are in the defender general's offices, those who are judges, those who are in corrections? Because really what we're looking at is we're looking at a criminal justice system, which is informed by bias. And as you said, everyone is informed by their personal biases. So what would you say to them to get them on the right track so we can address systemically as opposed to just looking at law enforcement?
Interesting point, Mark. Thanks for the call. Colonel.
Well, I mean, I agree with Mark, and I don't think there's a lot of pushback, at least in from what I'm hearing, that this is a discussion that must take place across the criminal justice system. And I know I've had conversations with prosecutors and those in the system. I've met with the U.S. attorney. We've had these discussions. It must go across all aspects of the criminal justice system because law enforcement is one component of it. It is generally the beginning of the system, but we must address it system-wide. So I am engaged in those conversations. I certainly can take a leadership role, and I know those are taking place across the state. It takes time. I mean, the criminal justice system has a lot to it. It is governed by law in many aspects of it. So we have to get the discussion going in the legislature, and I think it's very important.
Let me take another phone call now. Let's go to Gretel, who's calling from Brownsville. Hi, Gretel. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, mine's on a side issue, I think. I'm a 70-year-old woman who's 5 feet tall, and I weigh about 95 pounds. And we have some sheriffs around here, around Brownsville and Redding in that area, who are just such bullies. I think the Highway Patrol does a great job, but the sheriff's group, it's like a gang. I've been pulled over and talked to so rudely and can't get out of your car and just bullied, just really bullied. And as I said, I'm not someone who would provoke questionable intent, you know, by my size or my age. And I wish somebody would deal with these people.
So, Gretel, your concern is more, you know, the personal skills, the communication skills of an officer, whether it's a county sheriff or a state trooper.
Exactly.
Colonel Birmingham, how do you deal with that with your troopers as far as, you know, we've seen some pretty disturbing footage nationwide about officers that overreacted when they pulled people over. How do you train your staff in that regard?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can only speak to the state police, and you know, I'm very proud of the men and women in the state police. We have a long history of very professional conduct. We hold our troopers to the highest standards we can, and we train them to the highest standards we can. And it really is about a culture and setting the culture that we do not expect any less than how you would want to be treated on a car stop, or how your child or your mother or anybody else would want to be treated. And that culture has existed for decades in the state police, and we continue to push that. I guess the one thing I can say is that training is a huge component. Hiring is very important when you're looking to hire new members of the state police. We have very rigid standards, but for a reason, because we want to make sure that we are bringing people into this profession that are capable of managing very difficult situations, have high levels of integrity, and, you know, serve the public in the manner that they expect to be served. So we really hold them to a high standard on that.
Garfield, in reading, emailed us this question. He says, does the colonel favor a national police training academy to improve training?
You know, I've never thought of that, but at first glance, I would say no. I think you have to. Every region of the country is so different and has so many different law enforcement issues that to push a national standard down would really not be effective. I think because we have very different issues than the city of Los Angeles. So it's important, I think, that there is at least a statewide control over what you're training your officers to and to what level. The Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council runs the police academy. They do a phenomenal job. We have additional training beyond the Criminal Justice Training Council for our troopers. And we really try and include many different things, from use of force to firearms training to emergency vehicle operation training to fair and impartial policing training. I mean, that's a component now of our training in the academy. So it's good that we can add and subtract depending on what we need to do and how we need to train our members.
The state police will be dealing with retirements as well as natural attrition, and I understand it's been hard to fill all your vacancies. Where are you right now as far as staffing?
Well, we have an authorized strength of 327, and at last count, we had 22 vacancies. We have 13 in the academy right now that will be out in December, but then they have post-basic training that will probably keep them out until about January or February. They'll actually be on the road through their FTO process. So in terms of numbers, we're doing very well, but we are faced with tremendous number of retirements now and into the next over the next 3 years. And, you know, we're putting on about 30 troopers a year, and it's a challenge for us. You know, 30 will keep us staffed where we are right now, but finding the 30 troopers is a challenge right now. It's a difficult environment nationally for law enforcement. You're seeing a drop in the number of applicants. I'm working very hard with Captain Jonas to diversify the state police.
I was going to ask you, how many women and minority troopers are there?
Well, I don't have the exact percentages, but I want to improve both of them. I think, you know, we have one of the highest percentages per capita in New England for female troopers. But I believe strongly that with a more diverse police force, you have a better police force. The challenge that we face is that our applicant pool does not reflect that diversity. So, and I can only draw from the applicant pool that we have. So we are working very hard. Captain Jonas is working with our training division, and we're really trying to think outside the box in terms of recruiting, going outside of Vermont, recruiting, you know, at very different venues, colleges, military recruiters, inner cities. And we're trying to Find qualified people who, and we are hiring now. So if there are people out there, you can go to our website, please, and fill out an application. We'd love to see it, especially people from minority communities and women. And those are our goals right now. And we're working very hard to achieve it, but it's extremely challenging.
Colonel Matthew Birmingham is director of the Vermont State Police. Colonel, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you talking with us on the program.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Coming up, a growing number of researchers are studying social media to learn more about what your posts say about you. Just ahead, we'll talk with a UVM mathematics professor who's found that the color and subject matter of the photos people post on Instagram, for instance, can be a good indicator for depression. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. For many people, posting photos on social media sites like Facebook, Instagram, or Snapchat is a way to share what they're doing. You're on vacation, you're visiting friends, you're at the beach, you snap a photo, and you share it. But researchers are starting to take a closer look at what people are posting and why, and they're finding some interesting things. Chris Danforth is a professor of mathematics at the University of Vermont. He and Harvard researcher Andrew Reese teamed up to examine how the photos people post on Instagram reflect their mental health, specifically depression. Chris Danforth joins me now in the studio to talk about the new study. Professor Danforth, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Nana.
So I have to say, I find this research fascinating. When you and Andrew Reese began, what was your goal?
Well, you know, mental health is an area of research that, you know, there's lots of people who could benefit from early screening. And there's been a revolution in data about the social sciences that came about when people started carrying around these mobile phones in their pockets and posting a good deal of information about what they were up to, what they were thinking and feeling on the web. And so we decided to try and learn from some visual cues what sorts of things were available about their health.
And what was it about Instagram that – why did you gravitate toward that social media site?
Well, people have looked at other social media, for example, Twitter and Facebook, and tried to understand what effect it has on your mood and what can be inferred about your mood from looking at what you post there. And you know, what we tried to bring to this project was some new methods in a field called machine learning, where you try and give a computer a whole bunch of data. Maybe it's visual data. In the case of the pictures, it was colors and, you know, whether there were faces in the picture. And try and learn something about it. And, you know, machine learning is a thing that people would be familiar with if they use Netflix or Google or Amazon when it tries to recommend something to you. It's learned about your behavior and trying to sell you something.
So before I get into what you were measuring as far as the photographs and the images, how did you get participants for this study?
Yeah, we used a popular service offered by Amazon, actually, where people can fill out surveys online. And we posted an advertisement to try and recruit people who were active users of social media and Instagram in particular, and had also been given a diagnosis of depression at some point over the last few years.
And what was the age range of the individuals that you were looking at?
Yeah, we were looking at adults, so people who were 18 or older, and we had a range all the way up through people in their 60s who responded to our survey. It was about 500 people ended up filling out our survey, and then when we asked them to share their social media history, about half of them dropped out because they weren't comfortable sharing that information.
And so what types of things were you looking at? Photos, posts, things that they would share? I mean, give listeners a sense of what all the things you were looking at to assess these folks.
Yeah, I think so one thing to say is we didn't actually look at the pictures, any of them ourselves. And what we did was have the computer look for the sort of the color spectrum that showed up in the picture. We also had look for whether or not there were people's faces in the picture. If so, you know, how many faces were there in the picture? You know, how many comments these pictures received on Instagram and how many times they were liked, things like that.
And so I think it's really interesting, you talk about this relationship with mood and color, looking at the color of the photos. Talk about why that correlates to mood.
Yeah, people who have studied depression in the past have found that people who are depressed tend to prefer darker colors. And so we weren't really sure what we would find with respect to that. But we did find the computer algorithm found that that people who were depressed were posting pictures that tended to be bluer and grayer on this color spectrum and darker It found that they were a little bit less likely to use filters, but when they did use a filter, it was a black and white one. So there were some visual cues that that the algorithm picked up on that were predictive of depression with respect to, you know, a control population of Instagrammers and their pictures, which tended to be brighter and more colorful. And so, you know, that prediction seemed to be – it was available, that information, before the diagnosis. So you could imagine using this type of tool to screen for depression. It also, you know, the algorithm did pick up on other features. It found that people who were depressed were more likely to post pictures with faces in them. But when they did, they were likely to have less faces in them, as almost an indication maybe that their social environment was diminished somehow with respect to the healthy participants.
It's kind of eerie thinking about, you know, what evokes mood in somebody or a state of mind. So you have this computer algorithm that you feed into your adding these people's photographs, or are you just putting images in for each person, sort of a group of images that they had on their website, and your algorithm then just assesses yes or no, this person seems depressed or not?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean,
I realize I'm oversimplifying.
No, that's okay. No, that's absolutely the idea. And the algorithm looks at the features, the visual features of photos posted by healthy participants, and tries to figure out what the differences are. And then we hold out a set of these sorts of observations to validate the model, and ask the model, you know, what do you think, this is a picture taken by somebody who's depressed or someone who's healthy? And then it tries to predict, you know, which category the photo came from. We also ask people to look at these pictures from the same marketplace, but different participants, and rate the photos as to whether they were, you know, happy or sad pictures, or how interesting the pictures were. And it tended to be the case that the sad photos, the photos that people thought were sad, were not the same ones the computer predicted were posted by a depressed person. So it wasn't, you know, many people found the black and white photography to be beautiful and happy and interesting, and so it was an indication that the computer algorithm was picking up on something that that people wouldn't necessarily be able to pick up on if they were just scrolling through their friend's Instagram feed.
So the algorithm might do a much better job at predicting depression, obviously, than maybe a group of friends looking at their friend's site.
Yeah, I suspect that it would. And, you know, we have some data on what the rate is that general practitioners can diagnose depression. This is sort of like your primary care doctor. And they're actually a little bit worse than a coin flip at being able to do it. And our algorithm was a little bit better than that. So, you know, the idea would be that maybe 10 or 15 years from now, all of the information that you communicate to your phone, it's, you know, texts you send, emails you send, words you speak into the phone, you know, that could be, with appropriate privacy protections put into place, that could be used as another source of information that a doctor uses to monitor your health, just like your cholesterol or your blood pressure, or, you know, what you're eating.
Wow. So I understand this study has not been independently reviewed, at least that what I read about that. Is it going to be reviewed? Is that the next phase for this?
Yeah, we often will share the research results we have while they're in the review process, and that's what we did in this case. So it hasn't been published in a journal yet. And I'll also say it's a particularly small sample size. So there's only a few hundred people who agreed to be a part of our study. And these are people who are active on Instagram and have been diagnosed with depression and, you know, fill out internet surveys. And so it's a particular group of people that we looked at, and the algorithm worked pretty well with them. And we're not really sure what would happen if we tried it with a much larger population, but it's something we would like to try in the future.
And did you let the participants know what you found, or once they submitted, was that it?
Yeah, as the protocol goes, we'll send them copies of the final publication, and, you know, none of their pictures or usernames have been made available with the study. That's an important thing to say as well.
You know, as I was looking at your study, I realized as I was reading more that this is a growing field. People are really looking at social media for research material. Where do you see other studies needed in this? What's next? I mean, what study do you want to do after this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, there are lots of scientific disciplines that have been revolutionized by, you know, new data sources. So in astronomy, there were telescopes that came about in the 70s and 80s and gave us pictures of distant universes. And we learned an enormous amount of information about the world this way. And in the 90s and 2000s, the medical field, through all the genetic data that was available, they've made an enormous amount of progress. And I think now with all of the mobile technology and communication happening on the internet, the social sciences, political science, and psychology. We're going to learn a lot more about how people behave, how we interact, why we make the decisions we make. And so this is it's an exciting time to be working on these types of problems. And I think there's a lot of promise for public health surveillance.
Yeah.
Chris
Danforth is a professor of mathematics at the University of Vermont. We've been talking with him today about a new study he co-wrote that suggests your Instagram feed might be able to tell us if you're depressed. Fascinating stuff. Professor Danforth, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Nina.
Well, that is our show for today. Tomorrow on the program, Vermont is home to an amazingly high number of talented cartoonists. We'll listen back to a recent conversation we had with three of the best in the state. We'll also hear how members of Rutland's Polish community were able to hold on to their culture from their homeland. And I hope you'll tune into that tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. And our executive producer is Patty Daniels. From the PEG TV studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.